This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers.
How's it going?
Hey, Bradley. Not too bad. How are you?
Crazy day here at the school, as always. We are about to kick off re-enrollment, so that's always a lot of fun. Well, it's the last time, because we are moving to perpetual enrollment, which I think is what you guys do.
Yep.
To where it's just going to be an opt-out if you don't want to come back. And a lot of schools in the U.S. are moving to that. Like, I know most colleges and universities already do that in the U.S., and so a lot of the private schools are moving to that as well. So basically, you have like a, instead of a window to re-enroll, you have a window to opt-out. Otherwise, you are re-enrolled for the coming year. So, yeah, this is the last crazy time for us.
Good stuff. I've always found that that's, to me, always the most interesting thing about going to America, is that you guys have almost all the same stuff that we do, but some of it's got this slight weird difference to it, you know? Like, why? How is it that your default is that way and our default is the other way, you know? But it's not like huge differences, which are so obviously divergent, you know? It's just like basically the same system, but we do it this way and you do it that way. And why? You know, because some guy decided at some point years ago, you know.
And then like he had hired people that ended up going to other schools and it just spread down the line.
Yeah.
So, yeah, crazy. So, yeah, we're, you know, we don't see, I mean, we usually see sometimes single digits not come back. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, why make everybody do something when really only like sometimes like seven people may need to tell you something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then kind of lead, and it helps us to kind of better plan, because we know, okay, you know, that this, the, you know, the people will probably be quick to withdraw rather than like quick, because usually people aren't quick to re-enroll because it means they have to pay like their re-enrollment fee and whatnot. And so now they'll be quick to probably withdraw. So we'll know ahead of time. So,
yeah.
So, yeah. So cool. some news about the show. We, sad news, after 5+ years, we are going to, over the next, I guess, 2 months, wind down the show. I know it's sad for us. No bad reason. Just it's 5+ years, and it's crazy all the things that have changed in that time. When we started the show, like, you had 2 kids, I had 1. My oldest was 2. He is now 7, and I have 2 more kids. And
I've got
more as that's, that's right. That's right. Yeah. You did have another one. You have 3 as well. Mm-hmm. So we did. And, you know, and you and I were talking, and we were kind of working through this, and so much changed from 2012 to now. We started the show August of 2012 with the idea to do like a season of 20 episodes, and we never finished. I guess we're finishing that season now.
Yeah, this is just the end of season one. Yeah.
Yeah, in season one. So 5+ years later, we saw kind of the rise of the iPad. We saw the rise of the Chromebook. We saw Wi-Fi evolve very quickly. We saw mobile device management get really good really quickly. Mm-hmm. And you know, we said, I think all we know to say at the moment about the current state, and I don't think things are going to change a whole lot in the next 5 years. And
Yeah, I mean, I feel that was kind of one of my sort of major drivers for considering ending the show, was that I kind of feel like we're coming to the end of the transition, if you like. Now, when I say transition, I don't mean that every school in the world has transitioned, but I think it's quite clear now, first of all, which schools have transitioned to the kind of new world, if you like, and which schools have not. And if those schools do transition, where are they going to go? Well, they're going to go iOS and that whole stack, or they're going to go Chromebook and that whole stack. And I think I don't see another platform that's going to come up in the next 5 to 10 years that's really going to heavily challenge either of those. I think your choice is really between Chromebook, iOS, or just doing what you've always done, you know. And I think in many cases, just doing nothing is usually the strong winner in most of these situations. So, but I think that the educational landscape seems to be relatively settled. That's not to say nothing new will ever come along, but I think we've lived through the rise of 2 platforms. And I think that you were looking at a fairly settled situation for the next 5 years, probably, maybe longer, I think.
So I guess really we should say school is going to be back in session, because that, the title has been out of school.
Back.
So, I mean, we'll obviously on our last episode, this is episode 237. We're going to have 3 more episodes after today. We'll wrap up with episode 240. And so obviously on that one, we'll say our thank yous to various people and sponsors from over the years. Mm-hmm. But just wanted to give our listeners a heads up on kind of where we're at. And obviously you and I will still be around on Twitter. Absolutely. And I will probably end up writing more on my blog, because I won't say it on here as much. And so, yeah, I've really enjoyed just a lot of the people we've gotten to know over the years through the show. And so, yeah, so that's it. So that's kind of sad, but it is what it is.
Sad but happy.
We're, good but to go out and high. Yeah, it's sad. Yeah. Yeah, we're not, I mean, obviously, like, there's no negative things here. It's just, you know, there's not many podcasts I know that have gone that long. Of the ones I listen to, like, that aren't just radio rebroadcast, probably Mac Power Users stands up to me. Obviously, a lot of the This Week in Tech ones have been around for a long, long time. But, you know, a lot of the shows I listen to, you know, they go a year or two, and then they kind of wrap it up. And so I feel very proud that we've been able to do this for, you know, 5.5 years, I guess.
Yeah, and the world has constantly fed us new things to talk about. I think that's been the most interesting thing, and I think that's how we were able to keep it going for so long, was that, you know, things just kept happening. You know, iOS kept getting better, Chromebook kept being interesting, new platforms, new technologies, all of that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying there won't be new ones in the future, but I think now is a good time to look at it and say, well, I think this is the end of this phase, and there's maybe a deployment phase to come next. But that's becoming a quite well understood technique and an easy thing to do compared to what it was when we started the show.
It's more of a turnkey thing now, yeah, than having to recreate something from scratch. So enough of that. Some topics today. iOS 11.2.5 did drop yesterday. So that is obviously, gosh, how long did iOS 11.2.4 stay out?
Yeah, this is Apple's new fortnightly release cadence. Yeah, I think it was about 2 weeks. And I know this because I've said this on the show before. I've never quite done it. We've been trying to implement this 2 week update window, where, but you know, if the update comes out on Monday, then by the next Thursday, which is sort of 13 days on, everybody should have updated. I've never once achieved this, and partly that's because every time I get to it, right, today I'm going to bring down the drawbridge and people are going to have to update or the apps are going to get blocked. Apple releases a new version and resets the clock. So yeah, we had about a couple of weeks of 11.2.2 and now here we are with 11.2.5.
Yeah, once we get to this point in a iOS, I am like, I kind of just quit caring. And I don't mean that like in a negative way, but I become less concerned about if something goes on like 11.2.4 or 11.2.5, unless there's like a major security thing that's been patched or something like that. But I just do kind of get exhausted with it at this point of the year. And not like, I don't mean that negatively, because I'm not saying like don't push out security updates, but like, yeah, it's just something I'm not going to like kill myself to try to get something done every 2 weeks because of how fast they're coming.
I feel like the frustration is that these are security updates, right? And security updates I care about. You know, a bug fix to like Exchange in Mail, I don't care about because we don't use that or whatever, you know, or something esoteric in the calendar. But, you know, for basic fundamental security stuff like the, you know, Wi-Fi or you know, Spectre or Meltdown and things like that, I'm like, I should really probably do something about that, you know. But like we've said before, the issue is that when you're dealing with individually deployed devices where you're using a passcode on the device, there's no automatic way to do this. So you've got to, I'm basically relying on, you know, a stick approach, which is if you don't update by this time, I'm going to block, I basically roll out that profile that hides all the applications until you do your software update. And that's the blunt instrument that I have to make people press that button. It's pretty tough.
HomePod isn't really something we're going to focus on this show. No. Other than to say, I'm probably not buying one. I don't think it's a bad product. I think it's the wrong product at the wrong time. I would be much more interested in a 149 speaker. Mm-hmm. Or like, I feel like they could have released two at once. Like release a big one. Like they could have released. This is like the equivalent of like a Sonos Play 3, I think. Yeah. Play 5. And I want like the Sonos Play 1 if I was going to have this. And I'm just, that's just a lot of money for me. And we listen to music through our Apple TV if we ever do it. Mm-hmm. And probably not buying one anytime soon.
I saw a comment on Twitter today that said something like, HomePod is a great opportunity to serve those customers who care about privacy and sound quality. And I'm like, if there's two things we know that consumers do not care about, it's privacy and sound quality. So good luck with that, you know. But we'll see. You know, it's surely going to be a competent device, but you know, it is not an impulse purchase for sure.
I think it's like a Sonos killer. I don't necessarily see it trying to compete with Alexa and like a Google Assistant. And like, I don't really still don't want one of those. I think I may have mentioned it on the show, but I have this like theory with these home assistants that let's say we had started with these like before the smartphone came out. Let's say like in 2005, like these devices came out and like you could talk to them. But then in 2010, your phone could do it. You would be like, oh, that's so much better. I have my phone with me. Or like you have a watch that can do it. Like if you just work it backwards, like does it not seem like we're going backwards in a way? I mean, I know the whole thing about like always on microphones and bigger microphones. I get that. But I'm just saying from like the trend in computing is always to be big, like in stationary, and then go mobile.
Yeah.
And we're taking this assistant thing in reverse. I mean, but there have certainly been times that like would have been nice. But I'm just not interested in putting a device with microphones all over my house. And if I was, it would be with a company that was very secure or very private. But I'm just not interested in that at this moment.
Yeah, no, I'm nothing else to add to that, Bradley. I just completely agree with you on that.
But we did get – the big news is we do have beta 1 of iOS 11.3. And, oh, there is some neat stuff in there.
There's new emojis for a start. You can be a Chinese dragon. You can be a skull. You can be a bear and something else. I can't remember. A lion. I think you can be a lion now as well. So I have an iPhone 10. I think I've sent actually zero emojis. Georgia sent ones for fun. but that was it. I don't know. I'm too old for that kind of stuff. But it's fun. It's a fun demo. I don't know.
I send them to my son occasionally, but like I have never sent one to really anybody. But that like,
you're not going to send them to an adult, right?
No. It's a fun. I mean, I'm not. Like, it's a fun. It's a fun feature.
Yeah. I don't hate fun, but you know.
Messages in iCloud is back, and I am really excited about that. I love that in the betas, and because I delete text messages, and I've kind of viewed them as an inbox to clear, and so I am really excited about that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be good because I recently had to. Reset my iPad, and of course, once you at the moment when you reset a device, you don't get your message history back on that device. And in principle, that's what messages in iCloud is supposed to do, is make it kind of more like your mail than like old fashioned email that used to come in and get deleted. So, fingers crossed on that.
And you do get the ability to control the battery smoothing, the power smoothing. That's not as big for me at the moment, but I could see if like you were a corporate manager and you had issues with like phones that were getting close to being off lease and that you were getting really slow, I could see where this would be a frustration of yours, and so that will be controlled. Now I don't know if that's coming via MDM. I wonder if you can control that via MDM.
Yeah, I bet probably not, at least not in the first instance, but I think this isn't this so weird. There's like there's going to be a button that says please crash my phone more. It's like, why is that, you know, I don't know. It's a PR switch, isn't it? You know, it's not a...
It is. Yeah. Now, we do get some new MDM commands, and one of them is a doozy.
Wow.
I'll let you read it.
Well, this is the one that I have, for the entire duration of this show, I have said, you will never get this feature, and it's actually here. And it's not exactly what people want, but and it kind of goes to our discussion about there are so many updates. You can now, by configuration, you can delay the ability to see of the users to see iOS updates for up to 90 days. So I'm going to just pull up the actual configuration profile reference key here. And it says, this is for supervised devices only. And it says, this restriction allows the administrator to set how many days a software update on the device will be delayed. With this restriction in place, the user will not see a software update until the specified number of days after the software release date. And it's basically an integer figure, which is between, it doesn't say a minimum value, maybe it's one, but the maximum is 90 days and the default value is 30. So if you, basically from when an iOS release drops, you could say, well, this shouldn't show up on user devices until, you know, 50 days after that release came out, something like that. So I presume with that in place, right, if you think about how this is going to work, we're talking about like a 14-day cadence for iOS updates at the moment, Bradley. So, you know, if say I was to set that to 30 days, okay, then, you know, after 2 weeks, I would be another 2 weeks before I saw that, right? But if in that 2 week period another release came out, it would be 30 days after that release that I saw the next one. So you could end up being perpetually, you know, 3 weeks behind or 2 weeks behind the state of the art. And I kind of get why. I think that's not a bad compromise. You know, Apple obviously wants people to update, but admins don't necessarily want people updating on day one. So it's a bit of a toss up there, isn't it?
Well, I guess we'll see in practice. So, like, let's say iOS 12 comes out and I have this blocked for 90 days. When iOS 12.0.1 comes out, does it automatically roll to that one? And does it give me a new 90-day clock? Or is it 90 days to go onto iOS 12? But they usually stop signing those.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Because then you're like, well, what if the only update available in my window is an update that's no longer signed? Does that just not show up? I mean, presumably they won't offer you an update that can't be installed. So you could actually go never seeing an update. If they very quickly stop signing the previous version, you could go weeks without seeing or months without seeing an update.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, we'll just see how that is in practice. Or if you could like disable it and then re-enable it and then it kind of kicks your 90 days off. I don't know. I mean, that'll be...
It's the kind of thing I could see using that to prevent the installation of a 12.0 update. Like, I would maybe apply that restriction in August and then take it off in October, right? Because you don't necessarily want the 0.0 release until you're really sure it's okay. But then maybe take that profile off and then, okay, the gates are open, right? So maybe you put it on when a major release is expected and then you take it off after a while so the point updates can all flow through.
A couple other things. Disable USB restricted mode. You can enable and disable Bluetooth if the Bluetooth settings are not restricted.
Interesting. Do you know what that's going to be good for? Yeah. See if you're trying to restrict Bluetooth to being on, right? Because one of the problems with Apple Classroom, Bradley, has been that if you've deployed your devices, some people will have Bluetooth on and some people will have it off. And up to now, the only control you've had is to prevent changes to Bluetooth, right? So you can't make it all on and then lock it. So what you would do is you'd use this feature to enable Bluetooth on all your devices and then apply the profile that says don't let the people change it after that. So this is a really nice way to kind of force Bluetooth on and then lock it once it's all on.
You can find out information for the apps if it's assigned to the device or the user, or if the source of the app is the App Store or the Enterprise App Store, or if it's a test flight beta. You can arrange web clips on the home screen layout on that payload. You can skip over some of the things in the setup. You can require teacher permission for a student to leave an unmanaged classroom in class classroom. Restrict the Apple TVs that the remote app can connect to, and reinstall deleted system apps with the install application command.
Some of those are MDM protocol commands, and some of them are configuration profiles. They're all in that list, but some of them are commands. Like, you might do in JSS, you might do an action on a found list of devices and do like reinstall application or something like that. So, and those are good improvements, I think.
Yeah. I would agree. It's nice to see that just continual evolution. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Swift Playgrounds?
Well, Swift Playgrounds 2.0 has been in test flight for a long time, and I kind of get what they're doing here, but it's kind of a bit disappointing as well. What Swift Playgrounds 2.0 is all about is they've put in a whole new infrastructure for making it so that you can subscribe to third-party publications of Playground files. So in 1.0, Apple provided a feed of Playground files that you could download, the Learn to Code books and so on. And then in version, I think it was 1.5, they brought in third parties into that system. So they made it so that like Parrot and Sphero and people like that could put their stuff into Playgrounds as well and you could download it. And now with 2.0, what they've done is they sort of outsourced that so you can publish a feed of Playgrounds files and people can subscribe to you in the app. There's also some new robot stuff in there, but as far as I can see, there are not actually any major new features for the app. So I had kind of been hoping for some stuff like the one thing that is killing me when I'm teaching with Swift Playgrounds is that there's no way to kind of have like a magnified view of the code. So when you've got your iPad up on a screen in the classroom, I'm always using like the accessibility zoom feature to make it so the text is big enough for kids to read when they've written my code or when they've read my code. So I was kind of hoping for some stuff like that, a wee bit more kind of teacher-orientated classroom stuff, but this seems to be the kind of priority at the moment, is getting more third-party accessories connected to the Playgrounds ecosystem. I get that too. But you know.
Yeah, and the downside with those is they're too expensive because like, you have to have one BB-8 for every kid.
Well, it's not a coincidence they're selling them in the Apple Store, is it? You know, I'm kind of like, is this just about selling more robots at the Apple Store rather than making it better in the classroom? But you get your point is well made, Bradley. I think it's always been one of my concerns when you see you get a one-to-one iPad program, and then you decide that, well, our programming is going to be built around programming a drone and programming Sphero. Well, now you're back to one between five, right? Unless you've got a Sphero per child as well. And that starts to get expensive too. So I've always kind of resisted doing that. I've played with Spheros, I've played with drones, but I'm kind of like, no, I want everybody to have something to program, not just the people who've got access to the drone or the robot. So yeah, we haven't really used much of that so far.
All right. So to wrap up today, what I wanted to talk about is I mentioned it on the last show about doing the G Suite backup using the Synology. And so I kind of want to run through how that went and just a little bit about Synology in general. So Synology at its core is a NAS. It's a network attached storage. And there's countless of these, Western Digital, MyCloud. I mean, there's tons of them. Synology pricing can range from like $169 for, you know, one with, you know, single disk one that doesn't come with a disk, up to, you know, a couple $1,000. I mean, they have a, you know, high-end enterprise grade one. Now, Synology, really what makes it popular is its software. They call it the Disk Station Manager, DSM, and it's like on version 6. Okay. And so it's really, really good. And that's, I mean, their hardware is great, but this is the reason you buy a Synology device. What are some things you can do with it? Obviously, you can do file sharing. You can do file storage. So, like, they actually have, like, a kind of a G Suite alternative in terms of, like, their spreadsheets and document apps, and you can host it all on there, and it can kind of do your own G Suite on device if you wanted to. You can use it as a Plex server. Plex usually doesn't recommend that for using the actual server because it's really slow at transcoding. Like, it's not a general purpose.
It's not a powerful computer in there, is it?
Yeah. Right, you're right. It's a very functional server, but it's not necessarily like a transcoding engine. You can use it as a backup, so like a Time Machine, a server. They have different packages you can install. So like if you have a Windows server, you can dump it to it automatically. Lots of different things you can do, and everything is like packages. So you just like go to their package store and install things. Mm-hmm. Most of them are free. There was one I needed to access a certain like file format, and it was like $3.99 one time to download it and install it, and it was from Synology. But again, there's like just countless ones. You can host like you can store your photos on there, and they have like a photos app. They have tons of apps on the App Store you can do. You can do a kind of run a VPN server through it. It's really, really robust in what it can do, and you get most of the features the same like on the cheapest one and the most expensive. I mean, there's obviously some things we'll talk about. But, I mean, it's a software, really, package you're buying. So I had originally picked up the DS418, and I looked at both it and the Play, and I was like, well, it looks like the big difference in the Play is it can do some transcoding, which I don't need. So I was like, this was $30 cheaper. Well, it turns out the Play Edition supported the G Suite backup, and the non-Play Edition didn't. And it had to do something in the processor. I guess it's pretty processor intensive to kind of sort through these G Suite files. So I had, unfortunately, to send it back and then buy a $30 more expensive one. So that really stunk. It kind of delayed me getting started going. I'm using Seagate NAS drives. So you don't want to use just regular hard drives in these because they're running 24/7. And so obviously these NAS drives are more expensive, but they're higher end. And so they're meant to last longer.
Yeah. I'm using a similar thing for the my Plex server in the house, Bradley. It's a Western Digital Red drive. So they have these green drives, which are like low power and quiet, but they have these red drives, which are designed for data center use. And that's, it's quite important actually to think about that because you're talking about maybe, you know, consumer hard drive, 2 years of continuous running, something like that, it's going to eventually blow up on you, and something you want to avoid if possible.
Now, the Synology can use like various types of RAIDs. You can use the RAID where it gives you, you know, like I have four terabyte drives in mine. You can have one that like where it gives you all the drives combined, but the downside with that one is if one of them dies, you lose all your data. I'm using what's called the SHR RAID. It's the Synology Hybrid RAID. And I'll have a link in the show notes. But basically the idea is it uses one of the drives as a parity drive. And so like I have 16 gigs of storage in the Synology, but I only have 10 available to me. And somehow I can lose a drive and not lose anything. I'm not sure how that works, but it is what it is.
Yeah, there's some dark magic in say RAID sometimes, isn't there?
If I wanted to upgrade and get more storage, I would have to upgrade at least two of them to be able to do that. So if I wanted to like, you know, if I put another 8 terabyte drive in there, I don't necessarily get more storage. I'd have to add 2 8 terabyte drives. So the main reason I bought this was for the G Suite backup. And I mentioned in the last show we'd been using Spanning and we had to pay for that. And thought, this would be like a way to do it one time. I'm probably never going to need this, but it's nice to have if it's there. And so you do have the setup was a little bit complicated. You have to go to the Google Console developer and build what's called a service key. And it is easy as long as you follow the instructions step by step. I'll have a link in there just kind of walk you through that. It took me about 20 minutes to do it the second time. The first time it took me 30 minutes. It didn't work. And I don't really know why it didn't work. I think it has something to do with the fact that I was using like my work email account rather than the actual admin account, which was the first account. That's the only thing I can think about. And I've even like deleted it and reset it back up. It's working well. I have the flow done how to make it. I'm not going to run through that just because it's just like creating some access and you have to download a file that you then upload to your Synology that kind of gives it access to your database. Because, I mean, it's not even like you have to log into users' accounts. Like, you have access to all of your users' data through this little service key that you create. So far, it's working well. The only thing I don't like is I can't see the user's, like, storage size beforehand. And so I've kind of been adding people slowly. Like, every time I do it, I have a backup running 3 times a week. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I do a nightly backup. It starts at midnight. It usually finishes about 1:30. And I have it set to keep, like, old backups for, like, file revisions for 30 days. And I'm like, every time I'm like, okay, how big is the... Because I don't have enough to do everybody, but I don't need to do everybody. But there's, like, probably 30 people that I want to do.
Yeah.
And, like, there's just a couple people I'm nervous about how big they're... Like, what I don't want is to, like, trigger somebody, and then they have, like, 11 terabytes on there. And like, it just, you know, obviously fail. And so I get an email from Synology that says, hey, you know, here it is. It usually, like, fail. It doesn't always – nothing finishes completely. And I go in there, and there's, like, usually, like, 5 files that it gives error on. Why? I don't know.
I mean,
it completes.
Can you use your Google Drive your Google Apps dashboard to look at user size before you add them to your Synology?
You can, but that would require more work. And I would just like to be able to like see it in Synology, like because it gives me a user list, and you can like select it. Well, and you can have it set to like you can even do team drives as well, and then you can have it set to auto discover new users, new team drives.
Okay.
So if you're doing everybody, you can just like set it to do that, and then as you add users, you don't have to add them in Synology.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty good, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and now Spanning Sync would have that issue where it wouldn't always back up all the files. It would give me errors, and it's like not like it didn't finish. It's just like I couldn't do this file for a certain reason. Again, I don't know why, and it's like, you know, it's 10,000 files and it couldn't do 3. I'm not super concerned about that. And who knows what it may be like a file format issue. I don't know, but like I said, I'm running the task 3 times a week and holding revisions for 30 days. Kind of set it and forget it. Like, I get the emails. Other than that, I don't even know it's working. Like I said, it starts at midnight on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, finishes about 1:45. And that's kind of it.
Cool.
I'm also using it as an FTP server. We had something at Mac Stadium I was using for, and I was able to, which they are wonderful. But obviously, it's a monthly fee, and I was able to kind of do that on the Synology as well. And so I'm really like, I'll pay based on what we're paying in kind of recurring fees. I'm going to pay the Synology off in like 8 months, so it's really going to be and there's no recurring fees, and this FTP server was easy to set up. And then what's cool is what we're doing is a user We have one option. We can either let this company FTP into us, or we can send something to them via FTP. But it's like a 13 gig file every week. And I just, you know, that with that and FTP, it's like, who knows? You can time out if they don't have a great connection on their end, and you're really limited on what their connection is. And so the way I have it working is I can install, like, I basically log into Dropbox on the Synology. And so all this user has to do is, like, drop this file. It's like a video file. So in his rendering software, he can, like, point it at the Dropbox folder, leave for the day, let it render overnight. Dropbox will then download it, and then we're done. And then it's the company's responsibility to FTP in and get it. And obviously, we have a fast connection, et cetera, et cetera, versus us trying to send it to them and being kind of limited with their speed and whatnot. And then that user actually having to, like, you know, actually initiate the SFTP connection.
Cool. Sounds great.
So that's kind of it. I don't know what else we'll use it for in the future. It can do so much, but there's like so much, I don't need it, but I have enjoyed playing around with it and learning about it. So, if you're looking for like a way to get into this, I think all in all, I spent like $900 for the Synology and the drives, all four drives. If you're interested in the G Suite backup, make sure you visit the Synology link I'll put in there to see which models are compatible. They're all compatible, but the DS418 Play was a good one. It's four drives. I think the Synology itself was like $429, and then once you add on the drives, and obviously if you get like, you know, 2 terabyte drives, it'd be cheaper and whatnot. But yeah, I'm kind of happy with it so far, and it's kind of a set it and forget it thing.
Cool. Can we do one more thing about Google Drive, Bradley? Some news about the Google Drive desktop sync client. I don't know if you've caught this information, but you remember the old-fashioned Google Drive app for the Mac and the PC where you'd have your folder that would sync in the little menu bar tool. That is in the process of being replaced by this thing called Drive File Stream, which is a much more sophisticated tool for Mac and PC, where basically it seems to make a kind of virtual file system, like a virtual disk on your computer. And then you copy stuff onto that disk, and in the background, the disk, quote-unquote disk, syncs back to Google Drive. This is Google's version of the Dropbox Infinite stuff, where you can see all your files, but you don't actually have them downloaded until you try and open one. But there's some news to say that they're in the process of shutting down the Google Drive sync client for Mac and PC. This is for people who are using G Suite accounts. But they've extended the deadline for that to 12th of May 2018. It was originally 12th of March this year. But what they're going to be doing is on January, the end of January, they're going to be starting to show pop-up notifications for anybody who's got a G Suite account that is still being accessed via Drive for the Mac or the PC. So that's something that if you are using that, you might want to make a medium-term plan for getting people off that or finding out who's still using that, and or at least telling people, you know, if you see this alert, please come and talk to me and I'll show you how to change it, kind of thing.
Yeah, the FileStream app is working well. I really like how it has access to the team drive. So yeah, we've been. I don't install it by default. We kind of just let everybody roll with the web app. But yeah. There's some people that have it installed and it works well.
Yeah, I'm using it on one of my Macs for if I make large archive files, like dropping them, I have an archive team drive, which is just, you know, get stuff out of my drive kind of thing. And you know, I've been dragging and dropping like 8 to 10 gigabyte files into that and letting them upload, and it is working really nicely.
Yeah, there's nothing like a set it and forget it upload.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's one of the things you kind of miss on iOS a little bit is, you know, you're sort of babysitting these uploads and stuff. So whereas with a desktop computer on an Ethernet connection, you just fire that away and you're done.
Yeah, it's like, don't go to sleep.
Yeah.
Cool. But if you have any questions about the Synology, hit me up on Twitter, at Bradley Chambers. And again, we'll have some links to in the show notes at outofschool.net. Anything else, Fraser, before we wrap up?
That's all from me for this week. Yep.
All right. Well, again, 3 more shows, and we're turning the lights off at Out of School headquarters. And so if there's any old episodes you'd love to download, we'll leave those up for a little bit, but I have to pay for that monthly, the hosting, so I'm not going to leave that up indefinitely. So if there's any old episodes you want, or if you want to go download the deployment series, definitely go do that.
Yeah, we'll figure out what to do about the archive. We need to think of maybe there's something we can do with Amazon S3 or something. I'm not sure, but we'll see.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. That is a good point. Well, all right, everybody. Cool. Have a good week, and we'll see you next time.